This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Arizona History, the program where we showcase people, places, and events that have helped to shape our great state. Today, we'll be reading an article from Volume 51, Number 3 of the Journal of Arizona History that was published in autumn 2010, entitled Only One Rattlesnake Per Tent, Lieutenant Vernon L. Springer's Photographs of Camp Hyder, Arizona, 1943, by Lloyd Clark. And although this is a photo essay, I thought that the textual descriptions of life in the camp would be of interest. Lloyd Clark is a former member of the Arizona Historical Society's Board of Directors and served as the Society's delegate to the Arizona State Board on Geographic and Historic Names from 1994 to 2007. He founded the Council on Abandoned Military Posts, or CAMP, in 1966. Men of the advance party of the Statue of Liberty Division halted their vehicles at an isolated way station beside the Southern Pacific Tracks, just west of the Maricopa County line in southwestern Arizona. The place was Hyder, Yuma County, the date April 1, 1943. Surely, thought these soldiers, mostly Easterners and from the New York area, this was an April Fool's joke. They had heard before leaving Fort Jackson, South Carolina, that they were to undergo 12 more weeks of training at a good camp in the Southwest. But this wasn't a military post. There was the yellow Cracker Box Railroad Station, a few adobe and board structures clustered around some tamarack trees, a corral, and cactus, greasewood, and other desert growth, all set in a forlorn landscape ringed by barren mountains. Any moment now, the commander of the convoy would give the command to mount up, and they would be on their way to the anticipated oasis. But that order was not forthcoming. As certainly as it was a Friday and the sun was shining, they were at their destination. It was their destiny, this April Fool's Day, to set up camp. Led by the 302nd Engineer Combat Battalion, the first arrivals went into action, clearing scrawny vegetation, blading roads, raising and staking tents, hauling water, digging latrines and garbage pits, all the while being wary of those creatures that inhabited the area for centuries, snakes, lizards, scorpions, and spiders. The initial shock of realizing that they had arrived in the middle of nowhere, in the realm of nothing, was followed by surprise encountered. "Sarge! Sarge! There's two big rattlesnakes in our tent!" someone shouted. The top kick withdrew the pipe slowly from the corners of his mouth and turned to face the excited young private. "Now, lad, there's been a expletive foul-up. I've told those jackasses in supply to issue only one rattlesnake per tent. You go turn in that extra rattler this goddamn minute." Riley, that was the only way to react to this strange situation. Just a week earlier, they had been in civilization. Now they were in hell, spelled Camp Hyder. Although the days were far warmer than those they had been accustomed to, the springtime nights in the desert were mild, sometimes even a bit chilly. Summer, however, was on the way. So was the bulk of the 77th Infantry Division, commanded by Major General Roscoe B. Woodruff. Trainload after trainload of troops arrived, day after day, until some 13,000 men set foot on the Palomas Plain, where tanks and other armored units had been training in the California-Arizona Maneuver Area, or CAMA, since April 1942. The 77th, home to World War I's legendary Lost Battalion, bore the dubious honor of being the first infantry division to undergo the rigors of desert maneuvers during World War II. At first, the nearest water supply was at Agua Caliente, 6 miles from the division's command post. Agua Caliente, or hot water in Spanish, was the site of the first Anglo settlement north of the Gila River in what later became Arizona. King F. Woolsey, born in Alabama and raised in Louisiana, came to this locale in 1860 and began growing wheat near the springs that pre-Columbian natives had long been using for their soothing and therapeutic value. The engineers soon shortened the distance to water by drilling a well near the Hyder Rail siding. Its flow was rated at 120,000 gallons per day. In addition to providing an adequate water supply for vehicles and for human consumption, there was enough left over for bathing. A huge shower facility quickly went up nearby. By the time Major General A.D. Bruce succeeded Woodruff, who was moved up to command of the 7th Corps on May 22, 1943, a tent city spread out 2 miles across the plains north of Hyder. Every company occupied a double row of pyramidal tents, each of which accommodated 6 men. Rocks were gathered, whitewashed, and placed as markers for company streets. The stones were also used to show unit designations and to identify specific areas. At night, the whitewashed rocks helped soldiers avoid tripping over taut tent ropes. After setting up house details had been completed, firing ranges and an infiltration course were laid out. In order to develop leadership qualities in junior officers, lieutenants were dispatched with their platoons on 6-day cross-country marches, using compass readings to locate caches of water and rations. A few instances of serious hardship occurred during these exercises, but no lives were lost. Small unit tactics evolved into broader battalion and regimental maneuvers. Soldiers' physical limits were put to the test. The standard Army ration of 1 quart of water per man per day was found to be inadequate in the high temperatures and low desert humidity, and the men learned quickly to take advantage of whatever shade the sparse Palo Verde or other desert shrubs had to offer. Second Lieutenant Vernon L. Springer was one of the Easterners being acclimated to desert existence. Born in Fall River, Massachusetts, he grew up in Tiverton, Rhode Island. At the time he entered the Army, Springer was working in the Stocks and Bonds Division of the West Indies Sugar Company in New York City. There were times when the sun seared his skin and the heat inside his tent became oppressive that Springer couldn't quite believe that his life had changed so dramatically in the past year. "Is this for real?" he would ask himself. Was he really opening a can of sea rations in this godforsaken land and drinking lukewarm lemonade out of an oversized tin cup that he had used that morning to hold water for shaving? Surely, Springer mused, he would awaken to find himself on the subway bound for Lower Manhattan. He would stop by the automat for a roll and a cup of coffee. That would help clear his mind of the bad dream. Then he would be ready to tackle the day's work at his desk in the financial district. Adding to the unusual juxtaposition of persons and events was Captain Rockefeller, Winthrop Rockefeller, grandson of John D. Rockefeller. What was he doing in this unlikely setting? But there he was nonetheless, serving as a supply officer, and Springer was his assistant. Believe it or not, this was reality. Springer thought it best, therefore, to keep some records to show his big city associates that he had been a part of this drama cast on the remote and desolate stage known as Camp Hyder. He took photographs and had photographs taken of himself. Together, they preserve a small facet of some Americans' involvement in World War II. The late Elizabeth R. Betty Springer of Phoenix kept them in her scrapbook. "My husband and I came back," she explained in a 1978 interview. "We moved back to Phoenix in November 1959 because of the introduction we had had to it during the war." Betty recalled that after Vernon had been at Camp Hyder for a week or so, she followed him to Arizona and rented a room on West Willetta near Central in Phoenix. Because the place lacked air conditioning, she immediately began looking for other accommodations. One day, in a local branch library, she overheard a school teacher remark that she would be giving up her room when the semester ended. Betty introduced herself, and the arrangements fell into place. By the end of May, she had a room and a bath, and air conditioning, with Mrs. Stein on West Coronado. "Vernon would come into Phoenix on supply runs most every week," Betty recalled. "Captain Rockefeller kept a room at the Westward Ho, so while he was there, Vernon would come out to our home on Coronado." In June 1943, the division moved in convoy through Yuma, crossed the Colorado River, and commenced maneuvers from an assembly area near Palo Verde in the northeast corner of Imperial County, California. As part of the 9th Corps, the 77th, along with the 7th Armored Division, the 4th Cavalry, and several tank destroyer battalions, opposed an enemy in the form of the 8th Motorized Division. The exercise continued into July, conditioning the troops to move great distances on short notice. The maneuver area extended 40 miles west of the Colorado River and from Ogilby in southeastern Imperial County, 140 miles to the outskirts of Needles in northeastern San Bernardino County. During the first week in July, the 77th made a 24-hour motorized march back to Camp Hyder. The old tents seemed much more appealing to soldiers who had been continuously on the move for 6 weeks. Spirits were further bolstered by the expectation of soon moving on, but bitter disappointment was in store as the division was ordered to continue desert training for another 60 days. The almost total absence of recreational facilities compounded the discomforts of tent life in the enervating heat. Although passes and furloughs were issued, returning to Hyder was discouraging to soldiers who had tasted civilization. Some energetic individuals looked for ways to improve their lot. Officers of the 306th Infantry Regiment constructed a rude adobe hut to use as a clubhouse. The officers of the 305th Infantry followed suit, going into the mud brick business to build a larger clubhouse. Post exchanges stocked beer and soft drinks, along with a limited amount of ice to chill the beverages. The Hyder Opry House, a stage erected at the base of a hill west of town, featured movies almost every night. Occasionally, a USO troop would appear, with the master of ceremonies typically requesting foreign service pay for entertaining troops in this out-of-the-way place. The Liberty Torch, the division newspaper that had last been issued at Fort Jackson, reappeared at Camp Hyder on August 26, 1943. The camp athletic program featured baseball and boxing competitions, and modern-day warriors soon appreciated the soothing properties of the Agua Caliente waters discovered by local Indians many years earlier. Division engineers constructed a swimming pool at the old settlement on the north bank of the Gila River. While recreational activities somewhat relieved the soldiers' discomfort, General Bruce brought in Lieutenant Colonel Gordon F. Kimbrell, a graduate of the British Commando Course, to continue training his division. Known as the Bulldog School, the course subjected students to realistic combat conditions as they crawled across the hot sand during a stream of live ammunition and amid the whine of exploding demolitions. Soldiers engaged in hand-to-hand encounters constructed and exploded booby traps and Molotov cocktails and fired from the hip small arms and light machine guns. A week of this schooling established an individual's alertness and self-confidence, or, as sometimes was the case, exposed his inability to withstand a desert combat environment. Despite precautions, several men were injured and one officer was killed in Bulldog School. On August 27, Lieutenant General Leslie J. McNair, Chief of Army Ground Forces, who had visited the 77th during its California maneuvers, arrived to inspect the division at Camp Hyder. At the time, the regimental combat teams were engaged in a grueling 6-day exercise in the mountainous terrain east of the camp. Extended foot marches, nighttime motorized movements under blackout conditions along narrow roads and over steep grades, and camouflage and concealment operations tested soldiers' skills and endurance. Simultaneously, reconnaissance and intelligence personnel tested their mettle during extended patrol missions over strange terrain. At the conclusion of the exercise, regiments underwent air-ground training and were tested on aircraft recognition, air-ground communication, and close air support coordination. On Wednesday, September 15, most of the 77th Division personnel witnessed a demonstration of close air support. At its conclusion, General Bruce took the microphone and made an announcement. The 77th will entrain in the next few days for Indiantown Gap Military Reservation in Pennsylvania. The ensuing cheer shook the ground squirrels in their burrows. By the time orders were cut and accommodations for overseas deployment were determined, some of the division's personnel had been dispatched to the A.P. Hill Military Reservation and others to Camp Pickett, both in Virginia. But to veterans of the desert summer of 43, it made little difference. Any place that sported greenery and afforded easy access to urban settings would do. The 77th Division's intensive training for desert warfare was subsequently tinged with irony. On March 31, 1944, the unit landed in Hawaii, where it commenced amphibious and jungle warfare training. Before the division was deactivated in Japan on March 15, 1946, it had fought on Guam, Leyte, Karamoreto, Hiroshima, and Okinawa, and served in the Hokkaido occupation on the Japanese mainland. 2,087 soldiers of the 77th Infantry Division were killed in combat. Its most widely mourned casualty was not a soldier. On the third Wednesday in April of 1945, combat correspondent Ernie Pyle was killed by Japanese machine gun fire on the tiny Pacific island of Hiroshima. The 77th's 1118th Combat Engineers Group erected a permanent monument on the site where the roving Scripps Howard reporter fell. Its inscription read, "At this spot, the 77th Infantry Division lost a buddy. Ernie Pyle, 18 April, 1945. Vernon Springer stayed with the 77th throughout its overseas service. He was scarred on his right side from scrapes with coral encountered during landings on reefs in the Ryukyus. His helmet was knocked off by a bullet on Okinawa. After he and Betty settled permanently in Phoenix, Vernon went to work as a civilian property officer for the Phoenix Police Department. On November 17, 1968, he came home early from work, complaining that he wasn't feeling well. He died of a heart attack at 4 p.m. A small contingent of Army personnel maintained Camp Hyder as part of the Arizona-California maneuver area until May 1, 1944, when it was turned over to the 9th Service Command headquartered at Fort Douglas, Utah. The Army Services Forces Organization presided over the camp's closure, along with all of the other installations in the CAMA Theater of Operations at the end of the war. In January of 1959, General Bruce returned to the Camp Hyder site during a winter vacation in Phoenix from his duties as Chancellor of the University of Houston. As he passed, for the last time, the two stone pillars that had served at the entry gate, the General saluted. Recollections of those hectic months in the desert and thoughts of friends and comrades remained keen in his memory. And that was only one rattlesnake per tent, Lieutenant Vernon L. Springer's photographs of Camp Hyder, Arizona, 1943, by Lloyd Clark.
Our next article is from the February 2021 issue of Arizona Highways, and it's entitled, "Trying to Keep Track." History's been made many times at Rialto Racetrack in Tucson. Unfortunately, history keeps repeating itself there too. However, despite several efforts to demolish the historic buildings and sell off the land, local voters and a nonprofit have so far saved the 78-year-old racetrack. And this article is by Kathy Montgomery. Rialto Racetrack stands like a time capsule along the banks of Tucson's Rialto River, a historic oasis surrounded by modern development. The track and its burgundy and white grandstand look much as they did in the 1950s, the timeless outline of the Santa Catalina Mountains rising up behind them. The history of the track is as colorful as the fans who still pack the grandstand for 8 weekends most winters. In the 1940s, J. Rukin Jelks built a stud farm here, at the end of a dirt road. With fellow breeder Melville Haskell, he created a rough dirt track that became the birthplace of formalized quarter horse racing. Based on early speed trials held on Jelks' track, Haskell wrote the regulations that gave rise to the sport's rapid growth. Innovations at the track include the photo finish, and the nation's fastest quarter horses competed at Rialto for top honors. Today, the track is part of a county park with 11 athletic fields, including 3 inside the oval. Over the years, it's faced pressures from soccer enthusiasts and developers. At various times, Pima County supervisors have considered demolishing Rialto's historic buildings and selling the land. So far, Rialto Racetrack has beaten the odds. But with the current racing contract set to expire in June, and the grandstand and clubhouse requiring millions in repairs, how it will look in the future is anyone's bet. As American as the Stars and Stripes, quarter horse racing dates to colonial Virginia, where horses raced down village streets or on short straightaways. Seldom run farther than a quarter mile, the races came to be known as quarter races, while the fastest horses were quarter horses. Introduced to the Southwest via Anglo migration, quarter horses proved well suited to the rugged, arid landscape. Versatile and well-mannered, they made ideal cattle horses for owners who often raced them on weekends. Haskell called the quarter horse the poor man's racehorse because races required no special equipment or training and could be run on any quarter mile of level ground. And, unlike in thoroughbred racing, amateurs ran quarter horse meets. At Rialto, local breeders, cattlemen, and sportsmen directed the races. An accountant ran the paramutual department, and employees of local banks served as cashiers. Jelks and Haskell came to Arizona within a few years of each other to recover from tuberculosis. Jelks from Arkansas in 1919, Haskell from Georgia in 1924. They bought neighboring cattle ranches in the Rincon Mountains. After his wife died, Jelks married Haskell's sister. Among the things they had in common, Jelks and Haskell shared an interest in horses. Haskell grew up on a plantation dedicated to raising and racing horses, and he and Jelks thought they could improve Arizona's stock. Using the best thoroughbred studs they could find, they set out to breed a faster generation of quarter horses. Jelks built his first racetrack in the Rincon Creek Wash in the early 1930s. When it washed out, he carved another one on his cattle ranch. There, Jelks and Haskell began hosting speed trials to show what their horses could do. Around 1940, they helped Bob Locke build the Multaka Turf Club on Sabino Canyon Road. The following year, the Southern Arizona Horse Breeders Association held the first quarter horse speed trials at Multaka. By 1943, the top quarter horses in the country competed there for the title of World's Champion Racing Quarter Horse. By the time Locke sold the property that year, Jelks had sold his ranch and bought the stud farm, and he offered the use of his training track for racing. The Tucson Racing Association held the first organized races at Rialto in 1943. 2 years later, the SAHBA and the Tucson Racing Association merged to become the American Quarter Horse Racing Association, with Haskell and Jelks among the founding members. By 1945, all quarter horse racetracks in the country had adopted Rialto's regulations and course specifications, a straight 3/8-mile chute. During the 1947-48 season, Rialto installed a clock and a high-speed movie camera at the finish line, and the photo finish was born. With these standards in place, by the 1950s, quarter horse racing had spread nationwide. Rialto was at the geographical center of the two established racing circuits, and the top horses from both met each year to compete in the World's Championship Quarter Horse Speed Trials. Ironically, while the standards developed at Rialto were meant to ensure good sportsmanship, the track twice fell into the hands of companies with links to organized crime. Jelks sold the track in 1953 to an entity controlled by Peter Licavoli, a Detroit mobster who relocated to Tucson. A decade later, Empreze, a New York corporation with suspected mob ties, quietly assumed control of Arizona racetracks, including Rialto. Reporter Don Bowles was investigating the company in 1976 when a car bomb mortally wounded him. Many of the current structures, including the grandstand and clubhouse, were built during Licavoli's involvement when the track was expanded for thoroughbred racing. But by 1954, Rialto's ownership caught the attention of then Pima County attorney Mo Udall, and the company divested itself of criminal shareholders. The Pima County Sheriff's Department took over the track after Licavoli's company defaulted on its taxes in the early 1960s. And in 1965, the department conveyed it to Empreze. Empreze gifted the track to Pima County in 1971, a year before that company was convicted on a federal conspiracy charge. In subsequent years, Rialto lost ground to modern racing facilities, sometimes shutting down for years at a time. In 1982, the Pima County Board of Supervisors voted to sell the land to developers, but a citizen ballot initiative saved it and preserved racing there. By 1992, the track had become part of a multi-use public park with a growing number of athletic fields. In 2006 and 2014, county supervisors voted to tear down the grandstand to build more fields, but voters defeated bond measures that would have funded those plans. The chute has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1986, and in 2010, a group organized to add the historic racing structures. With a background in preservation architecture, Jay Wells saw Jelks Stud Farm as the key. This brought in the historic element, the cultural element, and it really did work, Wells says. That's really what saved it, that and the downturn in 2008 when they couldn't sell bonds. In 2012, the stud farm, grandstand, and clubhouse were added to the National Register of Historic Places as part of a historic district. Meanwhile, Wells and his partners formed the Rialto Park Foundation and negotiated an agreement to restore the Jelks House and develop the Museum of the Western Horse and Rider, incorporating Jelks memorabilia. The partners also won the racing contract in 2014. Since that time, we've kind of made a peace, Wells said. As this story goes to print, the museum has received funding but is still in development, while the pandemic has made a 2021 racing season uncertain. Pima County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry says he can't predict the outcome of the racing contract renewal. And while he says he'd still like to see the grandstand and clubhouse replaced by modern multipurpose facilities, he doesn't see the track or horse racing going away. It's survived many other hiatuses, he says. The track will always be there. And that concludes our article from Arizona Highways, Trying to Keep Track, by Kathy Montgomery. Thank you for joining us for Arizona History. This has been Dan Klinger, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.